Thank you, Latham, and thank you all for the kind introduction to speak here. So this talk is based on a paper that I put out last month. And as the title clearly suggests, it's about doing field theory in digital space. So the bulk of this talk will be about a mathematical method that we developed to help us deal with loop integrals in digital. And the reason that we are interested in these calculations is because we are studying inflationary cosmology. So to be briefly review and also to kind of introduce the scales in the problem. I'll start by talking about just inflation really quick. So we know from the theory of inflation that the very early universe underwent a period of rapid expansion.
Rapid Wilbur.
What's that? Oh, okay. Yeah, so we know the if the theory of inflation is to be believed, the earlier universe underwent a period of rapid expansion, during which time it was described by an approximately Disitor metric, as shown here in the bottom right corner. And this rapid expansion was driven by an inflaton field. So I have a cartoon here on the right where I show a particular mode of the inflaton field. And as inflation proceeds, the background space is stressed and this inflaton mode is stressed along with it. And at some point, the wavelength of this inflaton mode is going to be much larger than the fundamental length scale in the problem, which is the inverse of the Hubble parameter h. And when that happens, smaller and smaller portions of the inflaton mode remain in causal contact with itself. And this process is called freeze out. And at some point, of course, inflation ends and these super Hubble fluctuations re-enter the horizon and seed the structure that we see in the night sky. So the summary is that our cosmological observations depend on modes which have this property, which is that its physical wave number is much smaller than h, which is the Hubble parameter. Now, you can already see that this picture must break down because I've only shown one mode in this picture, but there are infinitely many modes. And when you turn on interactions, the modes mix with each other. So it's not clear that this picture is really true when you have an interacting theory. And of course, the natural next step when you have interactions is to try and do, in case of weak interactions, is to try and do a perturbative calculation. But if you do perturbative calculations in Disitor space, you're going to run into a bunch of divergences, just like perturbative calculations in flat space QFT, except that now you'll have some divergences which are unique to Disitor. So my focus for this talk is to concentrate on one particular kind of divergence, which is what is called the so-called late time or secular divergence. And I'm going to study this divergence for a scalar field theory in a fixed Disitor background. So this is an effect that appears as at most log k over ah, which is the ratio of scales that I introduced in the last slide. At very late time, k over ah becomes zero or approaches zero, and therefore the argument of the log approaches zero and the log blows up, and that's why it's called a late time divergence. These divergences are physical, and to properly interpret this, we will need to use something called the dynamical renormalization group. And I just want to clarify at this point that the point of these calculations is not simply to compute some minor correction to the shape of some correlator. What I want to do is try and understand what are the physical implications of corrections. Or in other words, where does the dynamical RG flow take us? Now, before I delve into an actual QFT calculation in visitor space, I want to kind of take a small detour and discuss a classical example which illustrates what I mean by dynamic LRG and secular divergences, so that you can see that it's just what you regularly know as RG in flat space with some small modifications. So the example that I have in mind is, of course, a simple harmonic oscillator. And I'm going to perturb the simple harmonic oscillator with some kind of nonlinear term, as I've shown on the right-hand side here. The perturbation is controlled by some small parameter epsilon. So our natural intuition is to try a series solution in epsilon to try and solve this differential equation. And if we do that, what we will find is the solution that I've shown here. So this is what you get by substituting this perturbative series into the differential equation and comparing terms order by order and magnitude. The leading term, of course, is the classical simple harmonic solution. So that makes sense. But if we look at the first order correction, what we'll find is that there's this pesky t minus t zero term here, which means that if we wait a long enough period of time, epsilon times t minus t zero is going to become an order one number, and our series solution is going to fail because our series solution was arrived at by comparing things order by order and magnitude, and we can no longer do that. So how do we save perturbation theory in this case? Well, that's where dynamical renormalization, dynamic LRG comes in. So the steps involved are as follows. First, look at the badly behaving term, which is t minus t zero. We introduce a new time scale and we split it into two parts. And then we notice that since there's a perturbation to the simple harmonic oscillator, the amplitude and phase are no longer constants of motion. So we are free to incorporate some time dependence into the amplitude and phase. And we use this freedom to introduce a counter term, which looks like this. And with the counter term introduced, I have a renormalized solution coming from my perturbative series in the last slide, which looks like this. So the t minus t zero has been replaced with t minus uppercase t here. Of course, what we've done here is that we've simply absorbed the badly behaving time-dependent term into the amplitude itself. And now we insist that the final solution must not depend on the arbitrary time scale that we introduce. And this is, of course, completely analogous to the Kalin-Simansky equation. And this differential equation in turn unpacks into a couple of differential equations for the amplitude and phase, which now carry the badly behaving time dependence. And if we solve these differential equations, we find that the amplitude and phase have this nicely behaved form that I've shown here. And that allows us to write the actual solution, which has this form. So a couple of interesting things to note about the solution is that, first, if we wait a long enough period of time, these exponentials go to zero. And therefore, we recover the simple harmonic solution, which is what our original intuition suggested. But at the same time, the perturbation is not without consequence. So even if we wait an infinite period of time, what we find is that the solution is going to enter some sort of limit cycle around the simple harmonic solution. So no matter how long we wait, there is going to be an order epsilon correction to the actual solution. And of course, once we have the actual solution, we can do a series expansion in epsilon and we recover the original perturbative series that was badly behaving. So we understand now what the perturbative solution was trying to tell us and what was actually wrong with it. What was wrong with it was that we weren't adding enough terms together, because if we added enough terms together, we would get this nicely behaved solution. And this is going to be exactly the same story when we do QFT in Dissiter. To set that up, I am once again going to do a scalar field I'm going to consider a scalar field in a fixed visitor background with a simple lambda phi 4 interaction. And I'm also going to switch to conformal time in my metric, in terms of which my metric can be written in this form. Specifically, I would like to point out that the time runs from minus infinity to zero. So zero is the latest possible time. And we can develop some kind of Feynman rules for doing perturbative calculations for this theory. And the basic element of such a set of rules will be the two-point function of the scalar field for a free theory. If I evaluate this with Bunch-Davies initial conditions, then I find that the two-point function has this particular form. And I would like to bring your attention to the fact that this two-point function is kind of problematic because it has two Hankel functions. So this is what makes all our calculations going forward a little bit difficult. The index of these Hankel functions, which I call mu, are a function of the mass. And I've shown a couple of examples of what values mu takes for different masses. I'm also going to be calculating in-in correlators. So these are pretty similar to what we know as the familiar Dyson series in flat space QFP, except that there are now two time evolution operators between which our function is sandwiched. So there is a time evolution operator which runs forward in time, and then there's one which runs backward in time. And we are evaluating the correlator at some equal time surface in what happens to this correlator at late time. So I'm going to take tau zero to zero at the end. This expression this expression unpacks into a perturbative series, not dissimilar to the perturbative series I showed before for the oscillator example. For instance, if I wanted to compute the leading order correction to the two-point function itself, one of the contributions would come from a diagram that looks like this. So if I followed all the Feynman rules and I wrote down the integral corresponding to this diagram, it would look something like this. So I have an integral over time and an integral over momenta over a string of Hankel functions. And I've color-coded the Hankel functions to each of the lines in this diagram. So my claim here is that if we were to somehow do this integral, we would find secular growth terms, irrespective of the mass. So how do we see that?
Can I ask a quick question? So,
yes.
I mean, doesn't the secular growth appear even for a massless scalar? So why are we focused here on looking at only these interaction terms?
The secular growth does appear for massless scalars. What I'm claiming is that it appears for all masses. So all massive and massless scalars.
But is there a particular reason why we're focused on this term?
This term meaning this particular diagram?
Yeah, like why the order lambda squared diagram is the...
This is just an example. I'll show you plenty of other examples. This is, I just wanted to demonstrate what a typical integral would look like. So this integral is not, I'm not going to spend the rest of the presentation doing this one integral. Ultimately, I want to do all kinds of integrals like this.
Can I ask a question?
Yes.
Generally speaking, in a curved space-time, there's no unique Fourier transform.
That's right, yes.
But in the sitter space, it's possible to have a Fourier base because it's conformally flat.
Mm-hmm.
So in particular, if you choose a Bunch-Davies vacuum, which is a de Sitter background, then it's Euclidean, it's equivalent to a Minkowski derivation. So in that case, you should be able to do momentum space Feynman integrals.
So what happens is that even So the time translational symmetry is not available for visitor space explicitly because of the scale factor here. And this is in fact one of the main observations that I make in the papers, that the correct basis to use is not the Fourier basis, but rather the Mellin basis. And I will address this in a few slides.
So yes, a specific Mellin basis allows you to go to momentum space.
Exactly. It puts the integrals in a particularly nice form that allows the integrals to be done more efficiently.
What about the non-uniqueness of the vacuum? There are many vacuum states.
Well, I am I work with the Bunch-Davis vacuum here, but I haven't particularly addressed the, or I haven't particularly thought about the non-uniqueness of the vacuum states, at least in this work.
So you are taking vacuum expectation values to get the Green's functions.
Yes.
So you have to know what vacuum state you have.
Well, I just assume the Bunch-Davis vacuum, if that makes sense.
Thank you.
Okay. I'll be happy to discuss this later.
Yeah.
Right. All right. So, in general, an integral looks like some kind of nasty expression like this. So I would like to know how to do this. But things are not as dire as I make it out to be, at least in some special cases. So for instance, if we consider the conformal mass, the Hankel function has this kind of innocuous looking form that I've shown here. So for instance, we can use this to compute the order lambda correction to the phi squared correlator. And if I use all of the Feynman rules, and if I put all the parts together and replace all the Hankel functions with this nice expression, then this is the integral that I need to do to compute this diagram, which is the order lambda correction to pi squared. Now, this integral is also divergent. So I am going to regulate it by continuing in the number of space dimensions, which is 3 - epsilon. And the reason that this integral is difficult to do is because time appears explicitly in the momentum integrals as shown here. So all of the usual bag of tricks that we employ to do flat space Feynman integrals actually do not help us here. But still, we can, with a great deal of pain, manage to simplify this. And if we do that, what we find is that the phi squared correlator at order lambda has the following expression. So this is, in fact, the secular divergence that I was alluding to earlier. This logarithm blows up as tau zero goes to zero, which is the late time limit. And to resum the secular growth, I can employ a procedure very similar to what we did for the oscillator example. And if you do that, what we find is that the 2-point function for phi squared gets corrected from its free expression, which is this, to this. So the effect of resumming this secular growth is that the operator phi squared gets an anomalous scaling, which is represented by this anomalous dimension gamma phi squared, which is proportional to lambda over, which is proportional to lambda. So this is, exactly analogous to what happened in the oscillator example. Now, when I first did this calculation in an early paper that I wrote with my advisor, Daniel Green, I started thinking about how we could do similar calculations for any mass, because one of the reasons we chose this particular calculation was this convenient form of the Hankel function. But we shouldn't have to rely on special values of nu to simplify expressions like this. So how do we do it for generic mass or general nu? The problem as I pointed out, is that the momentum integrals are no longer scaleless, so we cannot use things like dimraj. And we would like to avoid hard cutoffs because introducing a hard cutoff breaks the symmetries of the underlying visitor background. And also, I would like to have some kind of repeatable procedure, by which I mean that I don't want to invent a new method of doing the integral for every new diagram that I encounter.
Can I make another comment?
Yes.
What about the, if you have a scalar field, you have a first and fourth interaction. Mm-hmm. So you have the scalar field loop is quadratically divergent. Mm-hmm. It's a cutoff, which is always troublesome. If you use the mesh regularization, it doesn't see quadratic and quartic divergence, only logarithmic. How do you deal with quadratic divergences?
Quadratic divergence is in the sense of proportional to cutoff to the power 4?
Lambda square. Yeah.
Lambda square. Okay, yes. So you're saying dimraj automatically takes care of lambda square kinds of corrections.
It's a measure regularization. Doesn't take care of lambda square, only logarithmic.
Right, right. So, lambda squared. So, this is one of the things that Weinberg pointed out, that the particular kind of divergence that I'm dealing with only appears at most log of k over h. So
why is that?
Well, he has a careful argument, but in my way of doing the calculation, it'll become clear that the divergences correspond to an integral over a double pole. So if you consider integral of the form x to the power minus s over some double pole, and the integral, and such an integral always produces a logarithmic correction. So I'll show some examples farther down the line. So the way the divergence manifests in our integral always is in such a way that there won't be any lambda squared correction, where lambda is some cutoff.
Okay, well. I guess I have to believe you.
Yes. I can discuss this later. So this is one of things that it's one of those subtle details, but I'll be happy to talk about this later.
Yeah, sure.
Yes.
Is it fair to say that that you're just dealing with, you know, these IR divergences, the difference in the IR divergences because you're in De Sitter space, and that what John is asking about are UV divergences, which however they're dealt with in flat space would be the same as how they're dealt with here.
So just to kind of go back to the original point about a lambda square not appearing in dimraj. So it is, I would say that dimraj is kind of doing, or lambda squared would be shifts to the couplings in the theory, right? It would be a shift to the mass or a shift to something else, which we can think of those shifts as some kind of change in basis. For example, if we consider the matrix of anomalous dimensions. So, those shifts are not the reason that dimraj works and the fact that the results from dimraj agrees with a hard cutoff kind of calculation is because we can do such a change of basis and get rid of those lambda squared shifts.
So just one quick comment for the space. For large k, mm-hmm. and small wavelengths, short wavelengths,
Right.
You approximate Minkowski space, Euclidean yeah. space, actually.
Right.
So therefore, whatever is in Minkowski space has to be intersitter space.
Right. Yes. This is a great argument. So that's right. So the way we deal with that is we. So first of all, I am exclusively talking about IR divergences, which correspond to small k or k over a much smaller than h. The second aspect is that there is, in fact, going to be an RG flow associated with it, which we can think of as being kind of orthogonal to the dynamic RG flow. So we can imagine we do an RG flow, a regular RG flow to some scale, and then we fix the energy of our experiment, if you want to call it that. And then we consider the dynamic RG flow. So I usually think of it as two orthogonal axes. We our regular RG flow to some low energy, and then we consider dynamical RG flow to compute these corrections to the scaling of the operators.
So you're doing effective field theory.
Yes, eventually I will talk about an effective field description later. I'm sorry, Latham, does that kind of answer your?
Yes. Thank you.
Okay.
Please sure. continue.
Oh, what's that?
Please continue.
Oh, okay. Thank you. So the underlying issue is that we are working in a bad basis, as I've already pointed out. And by that, what I mean is when we do a QFT calculation in flat space, we don't have the time variable showing up explicitly. And the reason is because flat space has time translational symmetry, and therefore we can Fourier transform away the time variable. But recall that De Sitter space is also maximally symmetric. It has the same number of generators, symmetry generators as flat space, and it has translational invariance intact for space. And what that means is that time translations get replaced by dilatation invariance, and therefore the correct basis to use is not the Fourier basis, at least for the time variable. The correct basis to use is the Mellin basis, because the Mellin basis forms the eigenfunctions of the dilatation generator. So for instance, if I write the Hankel function as a Mellin integral, it has this particular expression. And the way I can leverage this is as follows. Suppose I consider a general in calculation of some generic correlator. It's going to have an integral, it's going to involve multiple integrals over time, multiple integrals over the spatial momenta, over a string of Hankel functions, just like we saw before. The AM variables here are some magnitudes of linear combinations of the three momenta involved in the diagram. So the first step would be to replace all of the Hankel functions with their Mellin representation. And what this does for me is that at the price of introducing an integral for each Hankel function, it releases the arguments of the Hankel function out into the open. And therefore, I can now change the order of integration of time and momenta and arrive at the expression shown here. So the momentum integral is kind of uninteresting. It's going to be some kind of a generalized convolution, which is going to produce its own set of gamma functions. The time integral is slightly more interesting because in the late time limit, which corresponds to tau going to zero, this is basically an integral over all time. And it's going to reduce to a delta function, which is a statement that there is S conservation in De Sitter due to dilatation invariance in much the same way that you have energy conservation in flat space due to time translation invariance. So the S's are really the eigenvalues of the dilatation operator, just like energy is the eigenvalue of the Hamiltonian. And that means I can actually get rid of the time and momentum integrals, or be more precise, I can actually do the time and momentum integrals and reduce it to integral completely in terms of the Mellin variables. So all of the divergences that I'm looking for are encoded in what is called a Mellin-Barnes integral, which is this expression here. So all I need to know now is to understand how divergences manifest in integrals that have this form. And to understand this, I'm going to first consider a very simple Mellin-Barnes integral as shown here. So I have an integral over a couple of gamma functions multiplied by the basis function. And recall that the gamma function has poles at zero and negative integers, and the residue at this pole is 1 over n factorial with some sign. So if I use these facts, I can actually do this integral with the method of residues. So I'll have a bunch of poles going to minus infinity, which I've indicated in red here, and then I have a bunch of poles going to plus infinity, which I've indicated in blue. Now, the contour that we choose to do this complex integral has to satisfy what's called the Mellin contour prescription, which is the condition that the contour must separate the left and right poles. And a simple way to see why this must be true is that if I do not satisfy this condition, if I put my contour to the left here or to the right here, then closing the contour on the left half side or the right half plane does not produce the same final expression. Also, a mathematical way to state the same thing is to say that the arguments of all of the gamma functions in the numerator must be positive. So if I insist on that, it must be positive when evaluated on the contour. So if I insist on that, then I find this inequality, which is completely equivalent to the diagram that I've shown here. So how do divergences manifest in this picture? Well, consider the integral here. So I've switched off one of the b's, or I've switched off b to zero. Now consider the integral for a also equals zero. So what happens in that case is that the gamma functions in the integrand have this particular form. And because of that, the zeroth poles of the gamma functions are going to overlap. But now this does not allow me to satisfy the Mellin contour prescription. There is no choice of contour that will separate all of the left poles from all of the right poles. Or in other words, this integral is not well defined. And this is a sign that the integral is formally infinite. And the way to circumvent this issue is to introduce an a that is not quite zero, but some small number which is slightly greater than zero. And what this does is it shifts one family of poles slightly to the left and creates this tiny space here through which I can drive a contour. And now I am free to close this contour on the right side or the left side. Suppose I close it on the right side, I can compute it by the method of residues. And what I find is that the residue at this zeroth pole, the zeroth blue pole, is going to be proportional to gamma alpha. So the original integral with a equals zero can be defined as the analytic continuation of this situation in the limit of alpha going to zero. And in that case, all of the divergence is encoded as the residue of this one pole, which I have separated here. It will turn out that the residue of all of the other poles are finite. The reason that this residue diverges is because this pole has a close proximity to this red pole here. In the limit of alpha going to zero, this picture will correspond to the contour getting pinched or squeezed like this. So this phenomenon is called contour pinching. And this is basically the basic idea that I'm going to use to identify divergences in my loop integrals. We can already see how this works by considering the following diagram. So this is a two-loop diagram that we had to compute for one of our other projects. Suppose I use all of the Feynman rules. I write out the integral involving the Hankel function. I replace all of the Hankel function with the Mellin representation of those functions. Do the time and momentum integral, boil it all down. I'm going to end up with Mellin-Barnes integral, which looks like this. So there's no longer any time or momentum integral as promised. And it is a Mellin integral over 8 gamma functions, which I have listed here. Now, if you pay close attention to each of these gamma functions, you'll see that they appear as gamma z times gamma minus z pairs, which is exactly the situation that I have described here. So what that means is that there are 4 pairs of overlaps in this integrand. And if you do some combinatronics, you can see that you can have at most 3 overlaps happening simultaneously, because this is an integral over 3 variables, or you can have 2 of them happening simultaneously, or you can have just 1 happening. And by doing all of those permutations, you can see that this integral must have the following divergent structure, where alpha is some parameter that I introduced to shift the poles and remove the overlaps by a little bit. So without doing actually any calculation at all, I am already able to anticipate what the divergent structure corresponding to this diagram must be. Of course, to find the full answer, I will need to compute the coefficients C3, C2, and C1, which will need a more careful calculation. Okay, so coming back to the general case, a general loop diagram will correspond to Mellin integral that looks like this. Again, we only need to have to worry about the gamma functions in the numerator, because those are the ones which carry the poles. And the general algorithm is to introduce some regulators, which are the alpha case that I have shown in green here. That will result in a bunch of overlaps being resolved along different SL planes, where SL are the Mellin variables that we integrate over. So the whole problem of identifying divergences in loop integrals just becomes, is now translated into kind of this geometry problem of finding pole overlaps in this hyperspace of Mellin variables. Fortunately, there have been algorithms developed to do exactly that, because Mellin integrals or Mellin expressions have been used to do flat space calculations of complicated Feynman diagrams in particle physics. So I leveraged some of those ideas and I applied it to de Sitter loop calculations. So for instance, if I come back to the original problem that I started with, which was to do this integral for general mass, I can actually now do this integral for each of these legs having a different mass. So just to kind of illustrate that, I have written down the Mellin expression for this particular diagram with generic mass, which is what corresponds to these nu1, nu2, nu3, and nu4. And just to compare, I can set all of the nu's to the same mass, which is the conformal mass for which I already know the answer. If I do that, what I get is, once again, an integral over just some Mellin variables. And now there are a few more gamma functions, which I have listed here. But unlike the last example I showed you, the gamma functions are not in the form of gamma z, gamma minus z. So it is not immediately clear that there are pinches in this particular integral from just staring at the arguments of the gamma functions. So what you need to do here is to use the Mellin contour prescription, which is the mathematical statement that the argument of each of these gamma functions must be positive. And that is going to result in 10 inequalities, which if you combine in clever ways, reduce to this. So there are in fact 2 pinches, except that the pinches now are not in terms of one variable alone. The pinches are in a space of the sum of multiple variables like this. So for instance, this is a pinch because the contour choice of S1 and S2 must be between half and half plus alpha. So if alpha is taken to 0, the contours are going to be squeezed between these two. It's going to get squeezed in this interval. and similarly for the sum of all 3 million variables. And since the width of this pinch is alpha, yeah, they're going to produce a divergence proportional to gamma alpha. If I work out all the details, I find that the expression for this particular integral corresponds to this, and it gives me the same answer that I had from my previous calculation, which was much more painful. And of course, the advantage here is that I can now do this for any mass and not just the conformal mass. So if I do that for a bunch of different masses and plot the anomalous dimension for each of those masses, I can populate a graph like this. What it shows is the trend in the anomalous dimension with decreasing mass. So there are a couple of points here that I want to stress. The first is that a point that I already kind of alluded to earlier, which is that all massive scalars exhibit circular growth. So at least in some literature, there is a tendency to overlook this fact. Some people, I think, naturally assume that if you have a mass in the theory, all IR divergences are kind of automatically taken care of. That is actually not the case. The second fact is that as you go to the massless limit, there is an extra divergence that comes in, which is why there's a sharp rise in the anomalous dimension as we climb up. Sorry, as we go to the massless limit. And what that means...
Could you remind maybe the more observationally oriented among us what the anomalous dimension is and what we learned from this? Like, why are we plotting this quantity? What do we learn from this?
Well, the anomalous dimension is going to eventually show up as, let's say I non-Gaussian correlator. So we have some kind of 1/k2 some power expression for, let's say, the two-point function or some kind of cosmological correlator that we compute. So the anomalous dimension is going to show up as corrections to those functions. So that's like the most trivial way you can see that, but I think in, let me actually finish the next couple of slides and maybe that'll be, maybe I'll answer your question better, because I was kind of getting to that. I was kind of getting to something related to intuition at this point.
Okay.
All right.
So nu equals 3/2 is the massless limit, is that right?
Yes, that's exactly right. So nu equals 3/2 just corresponds to V over 2. That's right. How do we deal with the massless case? And by the way, massless scalars are, a massless scalar in a fixed visitor background is often a toy model for studying things like slow roll inflation. So it is important to understand how to deal with this extra divergence that occurs for massless scalars. Well, the usual method that is used is the framework of stochastic inflation. So stochastic inflation, it can be shown, is basically a resummation of the logs that appear in working with massless scalars. And a resummation of such logs manifests as a Fokker-Planck equation in this framework. So this is the Fokker-Planck equation if we consider that the noise is, or if we consider a Gaussian distribution for the noise. The Fokker-Planck equation can be thought of as saying that the scalar field is undergoing a random walk with a drift that is created by the interaction potential V phi and fluctuations due to modes that are crossing the horizon. So that is some kind of quantum noise contribution. And this expression, again, as I just said, assumes that the noise is Gaussian, which is why we only have one dou squared over dou phi squared term here. And a few months ago, we were able to actually compute the first non-Gaussian correction to the stochastic inflation framework, as shown here. So this is the NNLO term. This is the non-Gaussian contribution. And this was calculated using the phi cubed phi correlator that I showed a few slides ago. And this particular expression was computed in an effective theory description of the long wavelength modes. And the IR divergences of the full theory manifest as UV divergences of this effective description. Furthermore, very recently, we were able to also apply this corrected version of stochastic inflation to study the phase transition to eternal inflation. So eternal inflation has its conceptual framework, stochastic inflation. So you have some kind of slow roll inflation in which the velocity or the classical velocity of the field is approximately equal to the size of the quantum fluctuations. And that's when eternal inflation is supposed to happen. And I do not have enough time to incorporate some of those results into these slides, but the upshot of our paper, which just came out last week or a couple of weeks ago, was that, the conclusion of our paper was that the phase transition to eternal inflation is affected strongly by tails of the probability distribution P phi, as shown here, which means you can't, even for weak non-Gaussianity, which is included in this contribution here, you cannot actually calculate whether phase transition to eternal inflation happens, which at least for us was a surprising result. So just to kind of quickly conclude, if there is one key takeaway that I want you to take away from this talk, which is it's that the calculation of loops in Desiderata essentially becomes geometrized in S-space. And so this is something I'm kind of pursuing right now. I'm trying to understand more about this topic. And I'm also pursuing a complementary approach to doing some of these calculations, which is what is called the cosmological bootstrap. So that is basically what I wanted to talk about. Thank you.
Could I ask a question? There's this long-running controversy about whether these IR divergences indicate that De Sitter is unstable and that maybe De Sitter symmetry is spontaneously broken by their back reaction on the... So these calculations have all assumed that the De Sitter, that there's no back reaction on the De Sitter background, and they make use of De Sitter symmetry. Do you think you have any insight into that whole issue?
Well, I would say, so first of all my calculations assume a fixed De Sitter background, which is to say the interactions are assumed to be so weak that they don't really change anything about the background itself. But ultimately what we want to do is to do these calculations assuming dynamical gravity, that background actually does change due to these interactions. Right now, I would say I'm not anywhere close to being able to do those calculations. And all of the work that I've done is basically just under the assumption of a fixed De Sitter background. So I don't have any more insight into it than you would probably be able to find in literature.
Uh-huh. Could I ask another thing, which is that, am I right that this fact that the anomalous dimension diverges, as you, at least formally, as you go to the massless limit, does it end up making right. spectrum tilted slightly redder or slightly bluer than it would have other, the two-point function, is it slightly redder or slightly bluer than it would have been in the non-interacting, I mean, the is it slightly redder or bluer?
Right. Okay, so here, the correction is what I've shown here. So it's basically increasing the power of k here. which means that for smaller wavelengths, it's actually softening the IR divergence, if you want to call it that.
Okay.
So that means it's slightly redder.
Charlie? Yeah.
Hey, thanks for the really interesting talk. So I was wondering if these sort of Mellin transforms can be used for doing loop calculations in any conformally flat space time, or is there something special about the sitter in particular?
Okay, this is a great question. So to the extent that I've thought, to the extent that I've thought about this, the reason that it is possible to use Mellin transforms in this way is because you have dilatation invariance in the spacetime, and Mellin transforms have the correct basis to deal with that group. But the second way to think about it is to think about what's called the Ramanujan master theorem, which states that for a particular class of special functions, like the Hankel function, the Bessel function, and all of its derivatives, it is possible, or you are always guaranteed to have a very convenient Mellin representation. So in any spacetime for which you have mode functions, which are these special functions, it is in fact possible to use the Mellin transform and get some computational advantage. That is my feeling from looking at the literature.
I think that starts to answer it at least. Here's just a follow-up question. Uh-huh. Besides the sitter space-time, and I'm guessing flat space-time, do you know of any other examples where these special functions and only these special functions pop up?
You mean only, are you asking whether?
Well, I guess the way I interpreted your comment is, as long as my integrals consist of these special functions, then I can use these similar tricks. And I was just wondering what examples of, do you know of any other examples of spacetimes where these tricks will work?
So one of those is obviously ADS, because you have modified Bessel functions in ADS. One of the things that I'm investigating right now is a connection to ADS. And in fact, there was a paper recently, I think it's titled From ADS to DS and Back, which makes some of these connections clearer. So ADS also has similar special functions, and therefore it must be possible to use some of these techniques there too.
Thanks.
Yeah,
yeah. So very interesting talks. So can you go back to this statement you made about eternal inflation? Can you repeat that? I don't think I quite digested it.
Yeah. Sorry. I kind of rushed the last few slides because I had this instinct to try and pack more things into this talk than I had in a previous version of this talk, because we had some new results between now and the last time I gave this talk. So what I was saying was that in this particular expression, we have found the known Gaussian corrections to stochastic inflation.
I'm having a problem with this. Sorry, can you repeat? I think my microphone went out for a second. Go ahead. Yeah.
Okay. So what I was saying was that for the very first time, you were able to incorporate known Gaussian corrections to the framework of stochastic inflation in the form of this blue term that I depicted here. And we were interested in studying what the consequences of this extra term were for eternal inflation. Because even if this term were small, the transition to eternal inflation is a space transition, and even subtle changes to the time dependence can have huge effects on something like a phase transition. So that's why we were naturally interested in applying this equation to study eternal inflation. What we found is that even for models in which the known Gaussianity is very weak, we cannot determine with certainty whether phase transition to eternal inflation happens. And the reason is that when you So I have an extra slide here. Mm-hmm. Okay, let me use this. So suppose, consider the slow, imagine that this is slow roll. Mm-hmm. Eternal inflation is going to happen when the slow roll parameter, which is phi dot, is going to be as large as the Gaussian noise or the noise, right?
Yep.
So the basic picture is that the noise has the same size as the Hubble parameter, h, mm-hmm. right? So phi dot being h is the same as saying that f pi squared has to be of the order h. However, what we find is that is implicitly assuming that the noise has a Gaussian distribution. But what if it doesn't have a Gaussian distribution? What if it has fatter tails than a Gaussian distribution? Mm-hmm. Then you can no longer say that the size of the fluctuations are of the order h. Mm-hmm. So these fat tails are going to generate fluctuations more often, which are bigger than h. And because of that, this standard picture of a phase transition to eternal inflation breaks down. Mm-hmm. And so that is, or maybe a more physical way of thinking about it is that the tails are actually probing physics beyond the cutoff of the EFT of inflation.
And so are you saying that basically all the stochastic inflation and literature are wrong because of this then?
Well, that would be, well, I'm certainly not going to make that claim now, but it was indeed a surprising result for us. Mm-hmm. We just started doing that calculation because we felt that it was a low hanging fruit, but mm-hmm. It was surprising to us that that intuition failed because of exactly this reason. These fat tails increase the probability of large H, beyond H fluctuations just enough that we can no longer say anything about.
So are you saying that even lambda phi 4, which doesn't seem to have a lot of non-Gaussianity? I mean, I don't know whether that's, I mean, is this enough non-Gaussianity basically to make us make this paradigm wrong? Because I mean, yes. what I've heard was like DBI models, which have basically two big of a non-Gaussianity, then for them the stochastic inflation doesn't work because of exactly these fat tails. But then even for a small non-Gaussianity you have with, I mean, say a standard inflation, you say it still is too big.
Right. Which was what was surprising to us. Okay. Exactly. Mm-hmm. Right. So even for models with sufficiently weak non-Gaussianity that are consistent with current cosmological observations, mm-hmm. we find that we still can't say anything about eternal inflation.
Yeah, may I ask a follow-up? So not talking about effective theory of inflation, but just considering something like minimal inflation, you know, with the scalar potential, are you still claiming that even in that case you cannot get, you basically get things out of control, or using your equation which takes into account non-Gaussianity, we can still make calculations? Yeah, I'm quite confused about the statement.
Okay, so I did not catch all of that, but I think I understood the gist of your question. I would say that yes, even in the case of very weak non-Gaussianity, the tails of the distribution ruin this paradigm of thinking about phase transition to eternal inflation. And just to kind of maybe drive that point home, so if you look at the non-Gaussian correction here, it is over a factor of 1,152 pi squared. So this is a number which is something like 10 to the power minus 5. Even with this number, if we plug in current models of cosmological observations, we find that the picture of eternal inflation is ruined.
Okay.
Can you be more specific? What breaks? Like this perturbative expansion breaks, or when you say we don't, something, what is out of control? I guess that's a bit unclear.
Right. Okay. So what we expect to happen is that, so we have two cutoffs when we are dealing with, let's say, something like the EFT of inflation. One is f pi squared and one is lambda, which corresponds to derivative couplings, right? So for derivative couplings, we assume that there is some kind of implicit cutoff, which I'll call uppercase lambda. And we assume that we can do a perturbative series expansion in f pi squared over lambda. But what I'm saying is that the tail of the distribution is actually probing physics beyond the cutoff lambda, which means that the perturbative expansion in the cutoff that you do is going to break down. Or okay, maybe a slightly more intuitive way to think about it is this. So if I am somewhere near the peak, or if my field is somewhere in this region of the Gaussian, then taking the derivative with respect to zeta as very small is actually a good approximation, because it's kind of flat here, right? Mm-hmm. But if I go to the tail and the tail has sufficient non-Gaussianity, then I can no longer make that argument.
So I think this picture actually is a very good picture, because I mean, FNL for a standard inflation is like 10 to the minus 2. So you mm-hmm. have to go to zeta of 100 to actually get to this non-perturbative regime. But I mean, zeta of 1 already is a stochastic inflation. So why do you say then, I mean, even at zeta of, I mean, even if FNL is 10 to the minus 2, you don't trust the perturbative picture?
Well, I'm sorry, can you repeat that?
I was just saying that FNL is 10 to the minus 2 for like single field Sterling inflation.
Right.
So this 1 over FNL is 100.
Mm-hmm.
So if zeta becomes bigger than 100, then you are in a non-perturbative regime. But zeta, when it's already of order 1, you are in a stochastic inflation regime. So it seems that there's some regime between 1 and 100 where you could be perturbative but stochastic.
Right. Okay. This is one way of trying to think about it, which is that If you have a big enough tail for your probability distribution for zeta, that is the statement that there are at least some fluctuations where it actually overpowers the classical slow roll,
mm-hmm.
right? And that is the regime in which our ability to predict something about eternal inflation breaks down. And I think that might also answer the question that you were asking someone in the audience. I didn't really catch who. So that's usually the intuitive picture that I use. So your delta phi, again, this is just something I got off Google at the last moment. But imagine that delta phi is an arrow which is just as big as phi dot in the normal picture. But if you have a tail that is big enough, there is going to be not insignificant number of fluctuations which are large enough that it overpowers phi dot.
Right. No, I understand the intuitive picture. It's just the quantitative thing. But I guess maybe I should just read that in your paper and then.
Yeah.
So can I ask just one last question? So your formalism then in terms of these Mellin transforms. So if I have any products of just purely on mathematical grounds, if I have any products of Hankel functions, mm-hmm. then I can use it to do that integral. Is that correct? Or does it give me a closed form, or what does it give me exactly?
So in my particular paper, I am concerned only with identifying the divergent terms.
Uh-huh.
But if you want to find the full expression for the integral, which involves the finite parts too, which I'm throwing away,
mm-hmm.
then a more careful calculation is required. You're generally going to run into poorly logarithms and things like that. So it is just a highly mechanical procedure. There is no real, like, I mean, the difficulty is in doing the repetitive steps.
Okay, I see.
And you can find plenty of references, I think, for particle physics, which do exactly that. But if you're interested only in the divergence structure, then the problem is slightly more simplified, as I explained in the paper.
Okay. Cool, thank you.
You're welcome.
Can I make a comment? Question?
Yes.
It's assumed, you assume in your Lagrange for the scalar field that you have a lambda phi to the fourth coupling.
Yes.
You have a lambda phi to the sixth. It's not renormalizable.
Uh-huh.
So in the standard model for the Higgs field, mm-hmm. it's also assumed that you have a lambda phi to the fourth mm-hmm. Because it's renormalizable. But there's no measurement of the self-coupling of the Higgs field. For that, you need the Higgs to decay into two Higgs or three Higgs, which has not been measured. My question is, according to Paul Steinhardt, eternal inflation leads to a multiverse. Mm-hmm. And therefore, for a multiverse, according to him, you cannot test inflation. I know this is outside your talk, but I mean,
well, I would say even without imploring the idea of a multiverse, sometimes, I mean, you can ask the question, what is a cosmological observable? Right, so I guess we imagine this meta observer or God who can actually measure these cosmological observers across vast distances. But maybe I'm straying from your question here, but at least the way I understand it, or what we originally anticipated when we tried to do this calculation was we could maybe say something about whether whether the patch of the universe that we are in is still eternally inflating. Because we originally studied models of inflation which were consistent with the current cosmological observations, and we wanted to see if there was anything we could say about eternal inflation which was from those models which could explain what we observe right now. But as I've stated, we could not. So maybe that's all I want to say about that.
All right, let's
say, I'm sorry, that's a complete non-answer, but yeah.
Yeah, thank you, Akhil, for a great talk and answering all of those questions, and let's call it quits there. Thanks, let's thank Akhil again.
Thank you.